can always make stipulations in the marriage agreement. For example, you can insist that if you give permission for this marriage, Cornelia and the children, and children there will be, must remain in Amsterdam until a certain age, say 14 or so. He will look after his interests in New France, and now, I understand, in the English colonies in some manner, and travel to Amsterdam when business allows for protracted visits with his wife and family, and business partners. I have no hesitation in doing business with him, and I think if you set out to him that marriage with Cornelia is an impossibility without these provisions, he will accept it, perhaps even welcome it, as I see no indications that he would ever be a family man dandling infants on his knee, though I sense that he is lonely. He is one of those who cannot be other than lonely. He was born to it, and I dislike the idea of him clambering aboard Cornelia as if she were an Indian canoe. Pete Ross paused for a long moment. I might do business with him, but I do not want him for a son-in-law.
Some of your feelings are the natural feelings of a father for his daughter, but you need only to keep him in check. He is, aside from his raw greed, something of a fool. He is obtuse, has no subtlety, and often acts on impulse. He feels his position as a low-born, uneducated man who has had to make his own way. He can be manipulated. He has a respect for older men such as we are. He will listen to you. In this life, we meet difficult people. We must take the time to listen and try to understand them. We must never take an adversarial position.
Pete Ross, half convinced, snorted. I feel he can be dangerous.
Dear Pete, even a sparrow has a sharp beak.
If you set it out that Cornelia and any children must remain here, it is a way you could exercise control over the children, at least. You do not yourself have any sons, and a sturdy grandson or two might be a real benefit. Or, if the children are girls, carefully chosen sons-in-law could be useful. You might also add business terms that would be to your benefit, as well as his. You, after all, have 3 ships plying the China-Japan trade, and he has none, and salivates for them. And he has money, and will have more. He will make money for us, I know it. So be fatherly, but be watchful. It took Duque another year of cross-Atlantic courtship, not of Cornelia, but of her father, to get his way. But he persisted. He would have her. In Amsterdam, in 1711, he spent days with Pete Ross, who pored over Duque's account books with great thoroughness, listened to his future plans, and asked shrewd questions, weighing the answers before he allowed the marriage.
If I correctly understand what you are proposing, there would be a 3-way business partnership working the China trade. Charles Duque, Pete Ross, and Outre Verdwijnen.
Yes, said Duque, vibrating internally at the sound of the 3 linked names.
Well, in that respect, I think we can work an agreeable arrangement. The marriage is perhaps more delicate. My wife and I do not wish to part with Cornelia. You understand, she is our youngest daughter and her mother's pet.
Duque half smiled.
I am not refusing your suit outright, but suggesting certain conditions. We would wish Cornelia to stay in Amsterdam.
There was a long silence. Pete rolled and unrolled a corner of the paper on which he was writing.
I would make her a gift of a house I own in the next street, a very pleasant house, and close by her parents and sister.
Duque shifted in his chair. A house. Cornelia's house. His house.
Moreover, we would prefer that any children from the Union would live with their mother in Amsterdam. With her family, close by, she will be well looked after. You can live there, of course, but if you prefer, New France, or better yet, you may travel between that place and Amsterdam, not only on business, but to spend time with your family." He looked at Duquet, who sat with his face motionless and his mouth slightly open. Duquet looked at the tapestry that hung on the wall behind Pete. He saw only the figure in the border, a hawk stooping on a heron. The heron lay on its back, its claws up to defend itself, but the hawk was fierce and sure. Below ran the words, "Exitus in dubio est," which Pete, seeing his puzzled expression, said was Latin, meaning, "Escape is in doubt." Duquet's sympathies lay with the hawk. Pete cast aside the shell of the conversation and came to the colonel.
"The routes are well traveled, and others manage this. If you wish, I will put a ship and crew at your disposal for that transatlantic passage. How seem these conditions to you?"
Duquet nodded, for this was the connection he needed.
"Yes, yes, my thanks. It is a thing undreamed of."
He thought it would be better to have his Dutch wife in Amsterdam, leaving him free from female manipulation and vapors, but still serving as the blood link between Piet Ros and Captain Verdwijnen. He knew that wherever he was, he would be a stranger. It was a price. He would pay it. The marriage was celebrated with a wedding feast and drinking match that lasted for days. Captain Verdwijnen presented the couple with a splendid present of a set of silver vorks, the new eating implements. Marit's left eye bored into Duquet as he regarded the present. Although he expressed loud admiration for the forks, in his private thoughts Duquet took offense at this gift. He knew it was a reproach to his still coarse table manners. More to his liking was the handsome coffee mill, and the rich tapestry from his father-in-law. It was a week before Cornelia spoke a word, and what she said was known only to her and Duquet. Within 18 months, he had fathered a daughter and a premature stillborn son. Duquet thought constantly of that lost son, and it seemed everywhere he turned he saw rugged boys. Men his age were accompanied by stout, half-grown youths, shaped to their father's wills and callings. Particularly was he irked by the example of William Wentworth, a growing power in New Hampshire, whose wife produced sons as a shingle maker rived the shakes from a bolt of cedar. With 9 sons, what could Wentworth not do? He, Duquet, needed sons badly, and said so to Captain Verdwijnen one evening.
"You are in a hurry with sons as in all else," said the captain. "If you cannot wait until God grants your wish, you might get some ready-made sons from the Weeshaus, that place of orphans, as many as King Priam, should you wish. Indeed, I believe Cornelia is on the committee that operates the Weeshaus. You might speak of it to her."
He lit his pipe and looked at Duquet. "And let her choose the boys. Her affection will then be greater. She can see to their schooling, and you can have them trained in business matters or for the sea." Duquet was excited by this idea of adopting ready-made sons, and though he did not wish to leave the choice to Cornelia, he recognized the value of Captain Verdwijnen's diplomatic suggestion. Cornelia, who was on a committee that oversaw the operation of a home for aged women, not the Weeshaus, warmed to the idea of doing orphans a good turn. She said she would be pleased to choose several boys for Duquet's inspection and final decision. And so in 1713, Jan and Nikolaus, both 9 years old, became Duquet's sons and immediately began their schooling and a course in manners and correct behavior that Cornelia wished might rub off on Duquet. He had prepared a speech before he saw the children.
"Many boys would give their right hands for the opportunities that are being given to you. You have a chance to help build one of the great fortunes of the world, a chance to remove yourselves from the street mire. I, too, was a boy of the slums, not even so fortunate as to be taken into an orphanage, and you see I have removed myself from the mud."
As sometimes happens after children are adopted, late that year, Cornelia gave birth to a healthy, fat boy,
Little Outher, named for his godfather, Outher Vedvinen. Duquet was as satisfied as he had ever been, but could no longer put off his return to Boston and New France. Then, on the way to La Rochelle, a lightning bolt of an idea came to him. Why stop at Three Sons? In La Rochelle, could he not choose a poor but promising boy from the streets, a ragged boy as he himself had been, wild to escape poverty and a dismal future? He would find this boy himself and take him to New France, that he might learn something of the forests of the New World. He wrote to Cornelia and Piet Ros and told them of his find, a clever boy of 11, Bernard, who was now with him in New France. He would bring him to Amsterdam when next he traveled there, likely in the coming autumn, that he might know his mother, his brothers and sister, and be properly schooled.
"You see," said Captain Vedvinen to Piet Ros, "perhaps he is developing a kind heart."
Piet Ros kept silent. 20. Rough Deed. Back in New France, which people more and more called Canada after the old Iroquois word Kanata, Duquet was everywhere, examining, prying, measuring, observing, and calculating. He had sent Bernard, the boy he found in La Rochelle, to Cornelia for education and manners. Limbs and low-quality hardwood waste became high-quality firewood, and every autumn he packed 20 wagons full for the Quebec market and for Paris when he could charter available ships, with the promise of a good return cargo of tea or coffee or textiles, spices or china. But without the sure promise of a rich return cargo, let the Parisians freeze for all he cared. Leasing Piet Ros's ships was well enough, but he needed ships of his own. What fortune if only he could find a competent shipyard in New France. He had heard of some Quebec entrepreneur's discussion with the French government, but it had come to nothing. "You know," he said to Dred Peacock at one of their Boston meetings, "it is so without hope I fear I must start my own shipyard." Dred Peacock mentioned other possibilities, Boston or Portsmouth on the Piscataqua, or even the growing coastal ports in Maine. "You will get a good ship made with local timber at a low price in one of those ports. And do you not know that the colonists build ships especially designed to carry the great pine masts to London? Well then." And yet he delayed. The conversation veered from owning his own ships to the business of selling timber to shipyards. Duquet insisted he wanted English customers. Dred Peacock shrugged and connected him to an English shipbuilder and a new but promising yard on the River Clyde in Scotland, now joined to England by the Act of Union in 07. "Regard the map, sir," he said, impatient with Duquet's hesitation. "It's the closest point to the colonies, the briefest sailing time. There are signs of success on the Clyde, but they need good timbers. They will pay for them. It is an opportunity that cannot be neglected." Duquet took the plunge, and Dred Peacock took a goodly share of the profits, which increased year by year. There were good precedents in New France for trading with the enemy. Brûlé, Radisson, de Grosseyer had set the pattern. But arrangements with the English and Scots were at first secret, complex, expensive, even dangerous. It took 50 acres of oak to build one 74-gun warship, and in the hardwood stands along the rivers of New France, the forests began to fall to Duquet's ambitions. But he felt hampered by Quebec's distance from the money pots of the world. Never did Dred Peacock present his ill-formed face to Duquet in Quebec. Always Duquet made the trip to Boston. As they sat over their papers and receipts in the Sign of the Red Bottle near the wharves, the inn they favored, Dred Peacock had some advice.
"Duquet, it is past time for you to consider shifting your business operations to Boston, to the colonies."
He signaled to the waiter for another plate of oysters.
"Oh, I think on it," said Duquet,
swirling the ale in his tankard until it slopped over the rim, as if that settled the question.
I think on it often. I am half of a mind to do so, sir.
He had observed more hardwoods grew in the south, that great meadows and clearings made both settlement and transportation easier. Massachusetts Bay bustled with shipping. It was the better place for a man of business. And yet... Dread Peacock looked at the spilled ale with distaste. Duquet was an ill-bred boor, quite unable to even discern the picturesque, much less appreciate it. It was only his fantastic ability to make money that interested Dread Peacock.
Damn, sir, it is quite time you acted. Finish with thinking and act. Every day, poxy whoresons of millmen push into the forests and gain control over the land. In Maine, there are countless white pine mast trees. You know there is a damned great market for these if you can get them on a ship bound for Scotland, England, or even Spain or Portugal.
The dish came, three great succulent oysters gleaming wetly, each as large as a man's hand. Duquet nodded, but his face was sour. Dread Peacock went on, his voice vibrating.
Where there is a market and money, the businessman must act. And all this will be immeasurably easier if you operate from Boston rather than bloody Quebec. And with my help, these affairs can be managed.
He took up the first oyster. Still, Duquet hesitated. He had valuable connections in New France and a lifetime dislike of the English language. Dread Peacock babbled on.
And in any case, I understand there are many in New France who are starting to believe that the English will one day prevail, even as a hare senses its pursuers' increasing pace. Nor is it outside the realm of possibility that the colonies will unite, drive out the English, and seize New France. Stranger events have occurred. And let me point out that so hungry are the horse and Scots shipbuilders for the excellent timbers of America that some have removed to the colonies to be close to the supply.
Now he was in partnership with the two Dutchmen, and several ships belonging to Ross, Verdwijnen, and Duquet, but flying British flags, ran the seas between Portsmouth and Boston harbors and the ever more numerous Clyde shipyards. It was, they often told one another, like walking on a web of tightropes, but they swam in money as in a school of sardines. They had only to catch it in their nets, and share it with Dread Peacock. Over the next year, as his sons grew, fired by the detailed and advice-packed business letters Duquet wrote to each of them every Sunday, with Dread Peacock's help, he began to acquire tracts of woodland in Maine. Dread Peacock's genius in the legal procedure of acquiring remote townships could not be measured, and his old acquaintance from voyageur days, the surveyor Jacques Forgeron, scouted out the best timberland, Duquet learning the woods looker's judgmental process from him. To outsiders, Forgeron was a dour man who overcherished his plagued measuring chains. He could use a chain as a weapon, swinging it around and around until it gained velocity and the free end leapt forward to maim. Duquet knew well that long ago he had used that chain in the old world and then fled to New France to start anew. Duquet thought there were probably many like Forgeron, but he only shrugged. The old days counted for very little. Moreover, he was now a partner in Duquet et Fils, perhaps even a friend, if a business tie between two friendless men could be so described. Duquet and Forgeron landed their canoe one October afternoon on a sandy Maine river shore fronting one of their new white pine properties, 20,000 acres at a cost of 12 cents an acre. There was a narrow hem of ice along the shaded shoreline. The rich autumn light touched the deciduous trees with xanthine orange and yellow. Their swart shadows fell on the ground like fallen statues. Without speaking, the men began to gather firewood. Forgeron held up his hand.
"Listen," he said quietly.
They heard the sounds of chopping not far off and began to move cautiously toward the source. With an acid jolt of fury,
Duquet saw unknown men in pitch-blackened trousers cutting his pines, others limbing the fallen trees, and yet another scoring them. Two men worked with broad axes to square the logs. Duquet was sure they had a pit sawmill set up nearby. By their bulging pale eyes and doughy faces, he knew them to be English colonists. Although Duquet et fils had no hesitation in cutting big trees wherever they grew, it was intolerable to be the victims of that practice.
Hola!
Duquet shouted. Then, in his clumsy English,
Who say you come, my land? Cut my tree!
He was so furious, his voice strangled in his throat. Forgeron advanced beside him, lightly revolving his chain. The startled woodsmen stared. Then, still gripping their tools, they ran on an oblique course toward the river where they likely had bateaux. But one with a dirty bandage on his right thigh lagged behind. Duquet did not pause. He drew his tomahawk from his belt and hurled it, striking the runner's left calf. The man fell, crying to his comrades for help in a high, childish voice. One of the escaping men turned around and stared at Duquet, called something to the fallen one. The confrontation lasted for only a few seconds, but left an unfading impression of a man swelling with hatred. Duquet did not forget the man's mottled slab of face encircled by ginger hair and beard, the yellow animal eyes fixed on him, the sudden turning away and violent run for the river.
They come from the settlements along the coast, said Forgeron as they ran forward.
They bound their wounded prisoner, a boy not older than 14, and dragged him to a pine, tied him against it in a hollow between projecting tree roots.
You, boy, garçon, talk up or I cut first your fingers, then your balls. Who are you? What men you with? How you come here?
The boy folded his lips in a tight crease in either pain or defiance. Duquet wrenched the boy's arm and spread his left hand against one of the great humped roots. With a quick slash of his axe, he took off a little finger and part of the next.
Tuck, or I cut more. You die no head.
Duquet's bloody interrogation gave him the information that the main thieves were in the employ of a mill owner, a man named McBogle, an agent of Elisha Cook. Duquet had heard of Cook for years. All described him as a passionate opponent of Crown authority. But McBogle's name was new. Although his heart was pounding with anger, Duquet thought Elisha Cook and perhaps even McBogle sounded like useful men, and he fixed their names in his memory. He would learn more from Dread Peacock.
Why you come here, steal pine?
He said.
We thought only to cut a few trees, away from the surveyor's men. Show your wounds.
When the boy held up his maimed hand, Duquet said angrily,
No, not that. Only scratch. Leg wound.
He could smell the stink of infection from a distance. With his good hand, the boy unwrapped his right leg and disclosed a deep and rotten gash in the thigh. It was a foul injury. A streak of red inflammation ran up toward the groin.
How happen?
He demanded.
Uncle Robert felled a big pine, broke off a branch that gouged my leg.
It was an evil mess. In contrast, the cut in the boy's calf inflicted by Duquet's hawk was clean, though it had nearly severed a tendon, and the chopped finger was a trifle. Nothing to be done. They carried the youth to the interloper's camp half a mile downstream, strewn with abandoned clothing and cookpots, a deer carcass suspended in a tree, and laid him near the still smoldering fire.
We will stay here, said Duquet to Forgeron, as the thieves have prepared a camp for us.
He tried to speak calmly, but he was filled with a greater anger than he had ever experienced. After all the injustices he had suffered, after all he had done, crossing to the New World, escaping from Trépanier, learning the hard voyageur trade, working out a way to use the forest for his fortune, learning to read and write and cipher, traveling to China, all the business connections he had made, these main vermin had come to steal his timber.
Forgeron brought their canoe up to the campsite while Duquet searched until he found the trespassers' pit sawmill. They had been there only a few days, but had the clear intention to saw. The stack of limbed and squared logs told him that. He wondered if they had planned to build a fort. It was said the English were plotting to build forts along all the rivers.
"Let us put our mark on them," said Duquet,
and he and Forgeron took possession of the logs with two deep hatchet slashes on the butt ends. They talked of ways to move them. In the end, it seemed a raft floated to the nearest sawmill might be the best way, getting what they could. While Duquet stayed to guard the timber in case the thieves returned, Forgeron went to Portsmouth to hire raftsmen. During the early evening, the mildness went out of the weather. The sky filled with clouds the color of dark grapes, followed by an hour of rain. Behind it, the temperature dived into winter. Duquet woke at dawn, shivering. There was not a breath of wind, but every twig and branch bristled with spiky hoarfrost. In the distance, wolves howled messages to each other, their cries filleting the morning. They had likely scented the boy's blood and infection, and would linger out of sight, hoping for a chance. Duquet got up and piled more wood on the fire. The wounded boy's eyes were closed, his face feverish and swollen, cheeks wet with melting frost. Duquet thought he would be dead after one more cold night, or he might not last until nightfall. With some urgency, he prodded the boy awake and fired questions at him. His name, his village, his family's house, how many people? But the boy only croaked for water, which Duquet did not give him, and then went silent. He still lived. Duquet spent the short day estimating the board feet in the felled pines. The light faded early as the growing storm invaded the sky, the wind and sleety snow rattling and hissing in the pines. While there was still enough light to see clearly, Duquet walked over to the prisoner. The boy lay on his back, the right leg bursting with infection, a yellow froth of pus oozing out from under the bandage, the leg a little splayed as though it were detaching itself. Nothing could be done with this burden except wait for him to die. One more cold night. The boy opened his eyes and stared at something across the river. Duquet followed his gaze, expecting to see Indians or perhaps one of the thieves returning. He saw only a wall of pines until a blink of yellow showed him where to look. A tall gray owl sat on a branch, seeing them. Its eyes were very small and set close together like twin gimlets. The boy spoke.
"Help me,"
he said in English.
"Help me."
Inside Duquet, something like a tightly closed pine cone licked by fire opened abruptly, and he exploded with insensate and uncontrollable fury, a life's pent-up rage.
"No one helped me," he shrieked. "I did everything myself. I endured. I contended with powerful men. I suffered in the wilderness. I accepted the risk I might die. No one helped me."
The boy's gaze shifted, the fever-boiled eyes following Duquet's rising arm, closing only when the tomahawk split his brain. Duquet struck the hatchet into the loam to clean it. In the flying snow, he dismantled the sawpit scaffolding and threw the boy into the pit hole, piled the scaffolding on top, and set it alight. The gibbous moon rose. Hours later, when the burning ceased, he went to shovel in the half-frozen excavated soil, but before he hurled the first shovelful, he glanced down and saw the black arm bones crooked up, as if reaching for a helping hand.
"Foutu! Done for!"
he shoveled. Forgeron arrived 4 days later with 6 men who began constructing a raft of the cut pines. There was no sign of the wounded boy, and although Forgeron opened his mouth as if to speak several times, he did not say anything, except that the war was making it very difficult to find able-bodied labor. 21.
Shifting Ground. Again, Duquet changed, reinventing himself. In Boston, Duquet et fils became Duke and Sons, and he was Charles Duke. Still, he kept his enterprise and some holdings in New France. He sat with Dred Peacock in the tap room of the Pine Dog, a pleasant tavern with a sign showing an eponymous carved mastiff, now their favored meeting place, as the sign of the red bottle had burned in a conflagration that took half the wharves and several ships.
"Do you know aught of that fellow, Mick Bogle?"
asked Duke, breaking the crust edge from his meat pasty with heavy fingers. Dred Peacock, bewigged and togged out, regarded his steaming coffee.
"I have not made his acquaintance, but I hear much deleterious talk concerning his ways. Maine is full to the scuppers with woodland entrepreneurs, sawmills, surveyors, armies of tree choppers, potash and turpentine distillers, and settlers, every man assaulting the free-to-all timberlands."
"They think as I do," said Duke, "so I cannot fault them. But although they love guns beyond telling and protect themselves, the woods are dangerous with enemies, not only war foes, but the Crown Surveyor's men, yet they are only men."
"The settlers are hard men, right enough, but there are others even harder, mostly in New Hampshire. I mean those men of Scots lineage, lately removed from Ulster in Ireland."
"Surely they are as other mortal men?"
"No, they are different. They are damned strange, cruel men, clannish and proud to a fault, thirsty for vengeance over imagined slights, hard-drinking and inhumanly tough. The Horsons prefer to sleep outside in storms rather than in the comfort of a house. They know the country as the Poxy Indians know it, and to live free is their banner. The buggers are impervious to cold and heat, and they bear pain as the Indians do, stoically and silently, even with relish. The ridges and watercourses are their highways, the forest their shelter. They choose to live in the most remote places, and they are bloody damned key fighters in the escalating antipathy between the French and the English."
He paused and took up his coffee cup, stared into Duke's eyes. "Dud McBogle, his brothers and his sons are among these men." Duke threw back his head and laughed.
"Well, I have heard bugbear stories aplenty, and I would class McBogle tales among them. No doubt he eats children as sweetmeats and wears a red fur cloak bespangled with their bones. What do you say when I tell you I consider taking this man on as a partner?"
For once, Dred Peacock had nothing to say. The ongoing war and marauding Indians forced Maine's settlements to cluster along the tidewater margins. Among them were several small shipyards. But Charles Duke discovered Penobscot Bay, where the great river discharged into the Atlantic, and where he built a large house. He thought himself the first white man here, despising a few French-speaking métis, fruit of the fornicating priests who had lived earlier among the Indians. The land around the bay, called Norumbega by an unknown explorer, was fancied by credulous souls to be the site of a fabulous city crusted with gold and gems, as Kinkenadon or L'Île Imaginaire. And here, mustachioed Henry Hudson had cut the first mast pine in the New World. For that reason alone, he liked the place. Duke's log house was more like a fort than a dwelling. Half the ground floor was given over to his business room, with its enormous table fashioned from a single slab of pine 4 feet in width. And it was time to bring his sons, now young men, to the New World and set them to work, although little Outre was still too young to leave his mother. His Amsterdam sons, Jan and Niklaus Duke, were fluent in Dutch, French, and English, with smatterings of German, Frisian, and Portuguese. Jan was especially good with numbers and understood the finer points of bookkeeping. He was as forward-looking as a raftsman in a rocky river. Niklaus, of imposing build, was physically strong and had a ruthless streak that Duke thought would make him feared at the bargaining table. He and Bernard were something of mariners, as both had several times sailed to China on the ships of Pete Ross. Jan and Nikolaus would deal with merchants, contracts, and shipping. The French son, Bernard, was on his way from the Baltic, where he had studied the technical details of manufacturing pitch and tar, and where he had picked up a little of the Swedish language and enough Danish to be useful. He would be in charge of naval store production. And he, Charles Duke, the father, would continue to establish contacts, buy up paper townships, and arrange for woodsmen and sawmills on the important rivers, to oversee the growing empire. It was time to gather his sons to him. And yet he was not interested in them in any way except an eagerness to recognize proofs of their success. They were the sons he needed. He wrote to Cornelia in English.
Best dear wife, I hope this letter find you and the childer in good health. I wished to write 3 days pass, but found ye inkwell so dry, no words in it, and by some unhappy chance, ye cupboard destit of supply. A cart come yester, and today I take quill in hand to write it is time my sons, whose care and education you have fostered, begin business life here with me in Boston and main coast New France. I will write them each and make ye arrangement firm. I am convinced they will succeed in all our proceedings with ye help of your dear father and uncle. They are as capable as I have ever wish. I regret when I am far from and destit of friend. Hear and hope join you 3 months' time. I pray that you will not want for happy company until I return. Charles Duke, Penobscot Bay, Coast of Maine. March 3, 1717.
He lodged his sons in Boston, but they came to the Penobscot Bay House once a month to meet in the business room, to spread out their papers and books on the great pine table. He had not been wrong. Already within a few months, the sons began to put forth their impressions and ideas. Jan, with his long, bony face and hazel eyes slitted as though squinting into the future, was perhaps the most long-seeing. But they spoke among themselves before presenting him with new ideas.
Father, said Jan, we have noticed that more and more English and Scots shipwrights are settling along the New England coast. We think it would be a sensible move to get a foothold in the shipbuilding industry. It would reduce the necessity of transporting lumber, masts, bowsprits, and yards to English or European ports. It is an opportunity.
Yes, said Duke. I have often felt it would be good to move into shipbuilding. Often and often, but I hesitated. You reassure me.
Also, said Bernard, who had confounded them all when he arrived from the Baltic countries with a great horsey wife, Birgit.
Pitch and tar. We have pitch pine here, of course, but the superior trees are in the Carolinas. And slaves. I would suggest that we purchase and operate a pitch pine plantation in Carolina.
It shall be done, said the gratified father.
22. Disappearance. In Boston one day, Dred Peacock came to him at the Duke Warehouse, a cavernous building near the docks, redolent of pine, oak, firs, and roots.
I thought you might wish to know that the man you mentioned some time ago has been asking many people about you, how many sawmills you own, how disgustingly large your fortune may be, what ships you have, what tracts of timber and townships you possess. He himself operates 5 or 6 or more sawmills on the Penobscot tributaries and in New Hampshire. He begins to look like a serious rival.
Who do you mean?
Elisha Cook, said Duke.
His damned hard man, McBogle.
Indeed, said Duke. I hear this sometimes. He asks questions, but we never see him. What is your own perception of this situation?
I think as you do, that he should be absorbed. He has the reputation of a dangerous man. I doubt we could buy him out, but a partnership may be attractive. He has friendly relations not only with Elisha Cook and the Wentworths, but with many judges and businessmen here and in New Hampshire. Yet he does not have our contacts across the Atlantic. It was Dred Peacock who had the invaluable English and European contacts.
We must talk with him and see what might be arranged. Where do we find him?
That may be difficult. He has what they call a thunderstorm sawmill, because the only time it runs properly is when the water is high with rain, on the Moose Gut and a house nearby. He keeps very much to himself in this remote place. If we go to him, we must bring a few men with us, for I hear he has a band of ruffians at his beck. I could accompany you a week today, but no sooner.
Bien, said Duke. Good enough.
Then, within the hour, Forgeron, who had led a crew of woodsmen to cut one of Duke's pine-heavy townships, arrived in Boston. His lean face was blotched with a red rash. He hesitated, as though he wished not to speak his news. When he did speak, he threw his words down like playing cards.
We found the best trees taken. The stumps still oozed sap.
Who? Said Duke.
Ne sais pas. Don't know. But there is talk that the man McBogle last week shipped 2 great loads of masts to Spain. He will have made a fat profit. He is known for tree piracy.
I plan to find this man in a week's time and see what can be arranged. We will work with him.
He is not known for compliance.
Nor am I. Dred Peacock will accompany us on the Monday. You must come as well.
Something had to be done about McBogle, and they would do it.
It is necessary we go in a body, as we do not know the strength of McBogle's men.
But over the last year, Duke's eyesight had begun to deteriorate, dimness alternating with flashing light and tiny particles gliding through his field of vision like birds in the sky. He said nothing to Forgeron of this, only,
What is wrong with your face that it shows so rough and crimson?
Forgeron shrugged. The plan was ill-fated. 2 days later, a packet entered Boston Harbor with great sacks of mail. Among Dred Peacock's mountain of letters was one informing him that his older brother and nephew had both perished in fire, and that he, Dred Peacock, had succeeded to the title. The Great House, now with a somewhat charred east wing, and the family's 2,000-acre estate, Dred U, in Wiltshire. In seconds, his talk of colonial liberty and rights evaporated. His self-definition as a man dedicated to New England self-rule shriveled.
I must go, he said to Duke. It is my responsibility to my family and to the estate, and the great yew tree now in my care. I cannot evade the title nor the responsibility. I leave at once.
In his voice, Duke detected a long-suppressed tone of haughtiness.
I will write to you when I have settled my affairs. I believe we can continue our business ventures.
Yes, said Duke. I quite see it.
Scratch some New England colonists, he thought, and you find Englishmen, as the bark of a tree hides inner rot.
But I cannot believe your chatter about a yew tree. What man would leave a fair and rich land for the sake of a haughty tree?
It is an immortal tree, centuries old.
It has been on my family estate since a time before Christ, since the time when men worshipped yews and oaks. It is nothing you could understand.
What could Duke say to that?
Nothing.
What mattered was the continuance of their business dealings. And as if that were not enough, word came that Forgeron was ill with a fiery skin inflammation and the quinsy, a putrid sore throat that forced him into his bed. Duke said he would not delay. He would seek out McBogle alone. He ordered a canteen of strong black coffee. He would ration it out, drink it cold, eschewing fires as the forest was sown with skulking Indians and French. A schooner took him to the mouth of the Penobscot, and he began his solitary journey. It was spring. Rafts of rotten ice riding the current in company with thousands of logs. Crowds of woodsmen stood on the banks, snagging the logs slashed with their outfits' marks of ownership.
The work continued all night by the light of enormous bonfires, cat-footed men running out onto the heaving carpet of mixed logs to hook and prod their property to shore. Impossible to put a canoe into that maelstrom. He had ordered his own timber crews to hold back his logs until the river cleared of the floating forest. Now he set out afoot, and noticed two riverbank men turn away from the heaving river and cut obliquely into the forest. He smiled. Did they imagine they were not noticed? Sometimes he was on dim Indian trails following landmarks, almost always obscured by the jagged skyline of conifers, but more often making his way through logging slash and blowdowns. Although timber cutters had worked the area along the river, a mile or so inland was still terre sauvage, and like the ocean, it breathed wild grandeur. Tree limbs arched over the silent earth like the dark roof of a tomb vault. He took an entire day to cross an autumn burn, charred trunks of the smaller trees with their own black limbs tangled around their roots like dropped drawers, still smoldering logs that could not be quenched. The biggest trees stood lightly scorched but unharmed. Winter snow had converted the ash to black muck. On steep slopes, it was the ancient wind-felled monsters that caused the greatest hindrance. Some, whose branches interlinked with those of their neighbors, had pulled them to the ground. Often, he had to crawl beneath these barriers. It was not possible to get around them as the way was blocked by other recumbents. He could not count all the streams and bogs. The treetops dazzled. The flashing wings of hundreds of thousands of northward migrating birds beat above him. He saw snowy owls drifting silent through the trees, for they had come into the main woods in great numbers that winter, and with the turn of the season were retreating to the cold lands. His eyes wearied of broken, wind-bent cedar and glinting swamp water. All one afternoon he had the feeling he was being watched, and as twilight thickened, he saw a gray owl flutter to a branch stub and grip him with its clenching eyes. Of all birds, he most hated this wretch. After 6 days, he cut back toward the Penobscot following Moose Gut Brook. McBogle's sawmill could not be very far distant. He listened for the sound of falls. He felt the mill through his feet before he saw it, the metal clank and rasp of the driveshaft gears and pitman arm sending a thumping rhythm into the ground. It was spring, he thought, and the entire forest would soon reverberate with the noise of multiple mills as water ran freely again. His eyes troubled him. Tree branches and needles sparked. Abruptly, there was the mill, a heavy log structure to take the weight of gang saw machinery. And there was Dud McBogle standing above him in a razzle of flinching lights. Recognition was instant. Dud McBogle was the ginger-whiskered timber thief who had long ago turned back and called something to the wounded boy. Duke felt a red cloud of danger envelop him. His blood instantly flowed back on itself. The teeth of the moving saws gnawed and glinted. He saw that he was fatally imperiled. Exitus in dubio est.
Been expecting you, said Dud McBogle in an easy tone. I went back, you see. I went back and dug up the pit where you burned my boy.
The two riverbank men stepped out of the corner and stood beside him. What could not happen began to happen.
Not yet, blurted Duke. I'm not done.
But at the age of 53, with his fortune only half secured, he was done. Part 3. All These Woods Once Ours. 1724 to 1767. 23. Dogs and Villains. He sat for an hour on a knotty and punishing pine bench before the governor's secretary beckoned him in. As a young missionary, Louis-Joseph Creme had first served in New France. Later, he had been sent to Port Royal in Acadie, a true wilderness, and among the Mi'kmaq, he began to keep a notebook of their rich vocabularies of geological structures, weather and season, plants, animals, mythological creatures, rivers and tides. He saw they were so tightly knitted into the natural world that their language could only reflect the union and that neither could be separated from the other. They seemed to believe they had grown from this place as trees grow from the soil, as new stones emerge above ground in spring. He thought the central word for this tenet, Wedji Squaliatimek, deserved an entire dictionary to itself. Now, with receding hair and arthritic joints, although he was only 40, he stood before the governor, shivering, for he felt a coming illness. Sleeping on the ground did not suit him. He was not of this place. He had not sprouted here, and so to him the ground was hard. The governor was a haughty snob, un bécheur, with a cleft chin and a bulge of throat fat. He gave off an air of having hung in a silk bag in the adjoining room until it was time for him to emerge and perform the duties of his position. His eyes focused on the wall, never meeting those of Père Crème.
"Surely I do not need to tell you that the English in Hudson Bay press down from the north. They press in from the sea. They squeeze Acadie. They press east from the Ohio Valley. New France is awash in spies, scouts, Englishmen and rangers from New England. The coast fishery is ravaged by English and Boston vessels."
The missionary thought that every sentence the man uttered had a subterranean meaning, if only he could grasp what it was.
"Your Excellency, the Mi'kmaq are constantly called to fight for France, although they have very few fighting men these days. They were once a vigorous tribe, as many as the hairs on 10 men's heads. Today they have but a few hundred warriors. As they die, they lose their sensibilities. Their knowledge falls away."
He hoped he too would not fall away. He felt quite dizzy.
"Their sensibilities. These people are masters of inventive cruelties. I mentioned to you the example of the young sailor captured from a fishing boat. The women, who are even more inhuman than the men, tortured him by fire and knife. They burned his feet with fiery brands, his legs, his privy parts. They cut him until he was pouring blood like an April freshet, then thrust his charred feet into an iron pot of boiling water. So speak not to me of their sensibilities. It is your concern to care only for their souls, and to inculcate in them love and respect for le roi notre prince, the king our prince, and urge them to fight the English. That is your duty."
He spoke as one confident in his position of power. Père Crème knew that temporal power had its limits, some of them very abrupt if one observed recent history.
"I humbly try to do so at every chance," he said,
feeling his chills switch suddenly to feverish heat.
"And in any case, that sailor was an English, a Protestant."
"That is beside the point. You seem to regard the Indians as special persons. They are no more than men, and not very reliable men at that. We are forced to use them as fighters when our territory, when the great fort we are now building at Louisbourg, is menaced by the English. It will be the gateway to our North American possessions. You know how important Acadie is to New France. France must retake it. It is vital sea access."
Now he was locking his fingers together and stretching them out. Père Crème forbore to mention that the fort could not protect the seaway. That was the responsibility of the French fleet. But he only said,
"Your Excellency, the Indians do suffer. They do have feelings. They love their country, which we are taking. They love their children, whom we are corrupting with our goods and forceful ways. They say France regards them as of little value, and this has long been their land, where untold generations have lived undisturbed.
Indeed. You know, Père Crème, you seem to me to be lacking in zeal for the cause of France.
No, no. I only pity them. They have lost so much, so many. Why could the man not grasp that the Mi'kmaq wished only to live their lives as they had for many generations, and that as every day passed, that was less possible?
And France has lost so many. You would do better to think of them rather than these libertine heathens who are dogs and villains. They are not Christians, as you, a designated man of God, might have noticed.
Père Crème, dismissed, tacked for the door, his feet at odds with each other and his neck wry. He prayed silently for the governor to become more observant, more kindly, or better yet, to fall down in a fit and never rise. He immediately withdrew this cruel wish and requested forgiveness. Several days later, he addressed a letter to his sister Marguerite, one of hundreds of letters never sent, for he had no sister. It eased his mind to have an imaginary confidant, and he was able to work out his sometimes chaotic thoughts this way.
Dear Sister Marguerite,
for a minute he imagined her, slender and pale, sitting in a green chair and opening his letter with a silver knife. She might wear a gold locket with a wisp of her brother's hair in it, or a miniature of their mother, whom Père Crème could scarcely conjure from his faded memories.
They do not have orderly lives as we do. Their time is fitted to the abundance crests of animals, fruits, and fish, that is to say, to the seasons of the hunt and ripening berries. One of the most curious of their attributes is their manner of regarding trees, plants, all manner of fish, the moose and the bear, and others, as their equals. Many of their tales tell of women who marry otters or birds, or men who change into bears until it pleases them to become men again. In the forest, they speak to toads and beetles as acquaintances. Sometimes I feel it is they who are teaching me.
He stopped for a long time before continuing with the feeling that he was getting it wrong.
To them, trees are persons.
In vain I tell them that trees are for the uses of men to build houses and ships. In vain I tell them to give over so much hunting and make gardens, grow grains and foodstuffs, to put order in their days. They will none of it. Therefore, many French people call them lazy because they do not till the earth. I have heard a story that in some earlier time...
24. Auguste. The children of Marie, Elfège, Théotiste, Achille, Noé, and Zoé, were trying to find their place in a world so different from Marie's stories of the rich Mi'kmaq past. The realities were difficult.
Dîner!
Called Noé without bothering to step outside, slapping down the worn wooden bowls, the old spoons. There was no response, not even from Zoé, who always had a remark. Noé stood in the doorway listening. The offshore wind had shifted slightly, but carried the fading clatter of boots on rock. They were wearing boots instead of moccasins. Noé knew what that meant, but denied it. She stepped out onto the path. Auguste clutched her skirt. She saw them far down the shore crossing naked rock. If it were just Elfège and Théotiste, but no, it was all of them. Achille, Théotiste, Elfège, and Rouge Émile. All three of her brothers and the cousin, and at the end, half running to keep up with the striding men, the slight figure of Zoé. anguish and rage mingled in her like a kind of soup made from nettles and grit. She shouted, "Go on, then!" and pulled Auguste up in front of her so he could see and mark this event.
"That's them," she said through clenched teeth.
She picked up a small stone and pressed it into Auguste's hand.
"Throw it," she said. "Throw it at the no-goods that has run off."
Her voice rose again.
"Go on, then, you hell brothers and damnation sister!"
And to the boy,
"Throw it! Throw your stone at them we'll likely never see again!"
But even as she said it, she knew it was untrue, that she was acting out an imitation of drunken Renardette's angry fits. She did not know why she sounded like someone she detested, nor why she spoke this way once again. She was not behaving as a Mi'kmaq. Why did she even think of Renardette, who was now deep in the past? The child cast the stone. It fell on the path. As it rolled, the boy saw Zoé, the smallest figure, turn and look back. Zoé, who responded to his outstretched arm, and waved. The lead figure turned as well, and his arm cut an arc in the air, a kind of salute from Achille that made Noé groan. The men should be setting out to hunt moose, but because of the boots, she knew they were going to work for the French logger.
"Come, dear Auguste, we'll eat all the dinner, just you and me."
Their house was a wigwam, and although Micmac sat on the ground to be in contact with the replenishing earth, there was a low, single-board table, the nails hammered into the legs from above. Before the stew, redolent of duck meat, meadow garlic, wild rice, and greens had cooled in the kettle, the door flap was pushed aside, and Zoé slid in.
"Not what you think," she said before Noé could start in. "They will cut trees on the St. John again. Rouge Emile heard from Eyepatch they should come, just this winter. Elfège said, tell you money is in his good moccasin. You use it for what we need, says he. They come back spring. Those cut logs go in the river. Come back a little bit rich, maybe. But not Achille. He goes moose hunting."
Noé nodded. If Zoé stayed, it was all right. And if Achille came back from his hunt in 10 days or so, they could manage for a winter. It was the idea of abandonment she dreaded. All her life she had been afraid of being left alone while everyone around her vanished. She filled a bowl with stew for Zoé and set it before her. When the bowl was empty, Noé filled it again.
"They didn't want to go, thinking what happened before. Rouge Emile's father comes to stay with us, so that don't happen another time. He comes soon, I think. Other people see those brothers leave, think just you and me here. They think just me. They see you go with them."
Zoé shrugged and made a face.
"Maybe. Maybe they see me come back, too."
A little later, Rouge Emile's father, Cachemille, appeared in the doorway. He threw something large and heavy wrapped in blood-stained canvas on the floor.
"Muinawa," he said. "Bear meat."
He looked at the stew pot. Noé filled a bowl for him.
"Good."
He told them he had shot the bear hunting with Achille a few weeks earlier. Not only bear meat, but he had brought his blankets and his flintlock. He would sleep outside in the small wigwam that Théotiste and Elfège shared.
"I am here. No male persons will bother you."
3 years before, the brothers had made a trip to La Hève, to the lumber mill, to ask if there was any work for them. But a man with a patch over one eye said the local Indians were sufficient. Go away. The cousin, Rouge Emile, was persistent. He stood beside a stack of cut planks.
"You got work for good axemen cut pine."
Everyone knew that the massed pines of Mi'kmaq lands were superior to the trees that grew along the Saint Laurent, which were coarse in grain and more liable to snap. Eyepatch nodded.
"It's summer, but there's always work for good choppers. Let's see what you can do."
He fetched 4 axes from the mill, then filled his pipe.
"See 2 spruce in front of the rocks. Take them down."
His tone was contemptuous, for he knew Indians were lazy and stupid. Eyepatch's pipe was not finished before the spruce lay side by side on the ground, topped and limbed. He reversed his opinion of Indians. He nodded, and they cut mast pines on the St. John River despite the summer heat and biting insects. In a few days they were crusted with black pitch, a kind of woodcutter's armor. When they first had arrived, the pine candles had been in bloom, each great tree pulsing out tremendous volumes of pollen until the sky was overcast, and the choppers and even ships at sea wondered at the brilliant yellow showering down. That summer, while they were swinging distant axes, Noé, barely 14 winters old, gathering wild onions, was raped by two boys from the French settlement, one of whom she recognized as Dieudonné, a fisherman's son who returned again and again for his pleasure. She could not evade him. He seemed to live in the underbrush near their wigwam. He was only a boy, a fisherman boy, with a red chapped face and eyes flicking as though he feared the priest was near. He was strong from hauling nets and pulling oars. At first she loathed him, but after some weeks he became affectionate, and although he was 2 years younger, she began to return the sentiment. He said he wished they could marry and would press the matter on his parents when he was older. When the brothers came back from the St. John, her condition was obvious. No one mentioned it. But the next day, Elfège looked at her in silence for a long time. He waited, and she told him how it was. By then, Dieudonné was weeks dead, along with his father and uncle and several other Acadians, for their fishing boats all had been caught in a concentrated snarl of storm that strewed the shore with broken boats. She thought of Dieudonné in the grip of the relentless sea as she had been in his grip. The result of the dead boy's life had been Auguste. In their childhood days in the forest, Noé thought, none of them had imagined they would come here to the ocean's edge, far from René and Marie's house. But they were here. She had not thought to have a child, but now there was Auguste. All this had happened because Théotiste and Elfège had brought them to Mi'kma'ki, the land of memory. 25. Sense of Property. Their great change had come about because of Renaudette, who caused their lives to become as different as those of strange people. For years at René's old place, heavy drinkers from Wobeek lurched out of the trees calling for Renaudette. One, Démon Maillard, appeared often, and Renaudette went into the woods with him. The day after René died, Renaudette rushed to Wobeek, to Maillard, a widower whose taste for spirits matched hers. Achille, Noé, and Zoé stayed on alone at the house in the ever-larger clearing. Achille trapped fish and hunted, cut firewood, as had René, and made hardwood potash. He sold this stuff to the traveling merchant who came with his wagon every month or two in the warm season. Noé and Zoé gathered berries, cowslips, fiddlehead ferns in spring, nuts, calamus root, may apples, sassafras, and many barks for the medicines they had learned from their mother. They made maple syrup. They had a garden, but it was small and weed-choked, for they had adopted Marie's distaste for cultivation. A few pumpkins sometimes matured in the fireweed. Noé made rather awkward willow baskets, which Achille sold to the potash man. Zoé milked and tended the cow. There had been two cows, but one died the month after René was killed, perhaps, thought Zoé, out of sympathy so that René's spirit might be comforted by a familiar cow spirit. Their lives were marred by unwanted visits from swill-wrecked Renaudette and her paramour. It was unclear at first why the couple kept returning to René's old house, but they came often, lugging demijohns of spirit, which they urged on Achille. Renaudette swaggered into the house, looking at each spoon, each wooden cup. Often she would examine a pot or a cloth and say, "Well, that's mine." Noé would wrest the object from her. "Nothing in this house is yours. There is nothing here for you."
This house is mine, said Renaudette. René gave it to me. He said, when I am gone, Renaudette, you have this house.
What lies!
Cried Zoe.
Go away!
Said Noé, swishing the broom.